call 1-800-FL today. That's 1-800-FL today. Or log on to weekendtoremember.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live as usual from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. And I'm doing something a little different today. I hope I sound good and clear. I'm sitting in a car in a parking lot. I've done this once before. When I travel, sometimes I'm between places when I have to do the broadcast live. All week long I've been teaching at Youth with a Mission in Jacksonville, Florida, and I'm still in Florida, but I'm between Jacksonville and another city, and that being so, I've had to pull over and do the show from the car. Now, you may say, how can you do a live broadcast from your car? Well, that's the marvel of some of the new technology we're using now. When I'm using the same machine, the same unit, same equipment that I use when I'm at home, where I plug into a DSL line and I connect to through the internet to our studios in Salinas. And I've been using the same equipment plugged into a DSL line in Jacksonville all week. But today, where I'm sitting in a parking lot in Florida, I don't have a DSL line, but I have instead a little cellular air card that I can plug into this unit, and I'm talking to you through the cellular service. And that means my voice is probably bouncing off of a satellite somewhere and coming back down to where you are. And that being so, there's going to be a little delay. In other words, what you're hearing me say right now, I probably said about 5 seconds ago or so. And or maybe just 1 or 2 seconds, I'm not sure. But you know when you watch news programs on TV and the interviewer in New York is talking to a correspondent in the Middle East or something, and the interviewer asks a question, and the person that you're looking at in the Middle East is waiting to hear the question for a second or so after the question's been asked, because it takes a while. Then they hear it, and then they answer. You've noticed, of course, that kind of delay if you ever watch the TV news programs. Well, we got the same kind of thing happening here today. When I use this particular air card, doing what I'm doing, we're going to have a little bit of a delay. And so when you talk to me, it may be, I'm thinking, a half second before I hear that you've spoken, and that is when you stop talking. I won't know that you stopped until about a half second after you did. And then I'll start talking, and you won't hear me until about a half second after I've started. So there's probably going to be about a second delay, I think. And I just want you to be used to that, be ready for that, because if you stop talking and you don't immediately hear me answer you, don't think that I didn't hear you. Well, possibly I didn't yet, but I will. And we just need to kind of make room for this little delay when we do it like this. I felt it would be better to put up with that slight inconvenience than to play a pre-recorded show. We do that more often than I like to already. So as much as it's going to be a slight difficulty, we've done this once before, and it was, but it's not very great a difficulty. And I welcome you to call in and talk with me and to our listeners today. As we usually have the same format, you call in with a question, if you have one, about the Bible or Christianity or anything related to Christianity, and then we'll talk about it here. If I know the answer, I'll tell you the answer. If I think I know the answer, I'll tell you I think I know the answer. And if I think I don't know the answer, I'll tell you I don't think I know the answer, but I may be able to give you some options. On the other hand, if it's not so much that you have questions you'd like to ask, or maybe I'm the last person you'd want to ask if you had them, well, then maybe you have some strong disagreements with the positions you've heard put forward by this host, and you'd like to get something like equal time. I say something like it because I'm not measuring the time. I can't promise you equal time, but I would like to have you get a chance to present an alternate viewpoint if you hold one, to provide some kind of a evidence or arguments, if you have such, because the purpose of this program is really and truly not to showcase the private opinions of this host, but rather it's a searching for the path, the narrow path, and searching in the scriptures as the authority on that subject. And I am not the final authority on the scripture by any means, and neither are you, but if we have differences of outlook and see things differently, we can pass them back and forth, and iron can sharpen iron. Maybe we'll both learn something, or maybe one of us will see that the other is correct. Anyway, it couldn't hurt to try. The number to call, if you'd like to be on the program today, is 1-800-438-5090. Yes, that's the same number you call when I'm at home. When you call that number, you're not calling me directly. You're calling our studio in Salinas, and then I'm patched through to you and you to me. So the number doesn't change. If you have a question or a comment you'd like to make regarding Christianity or the Bible, feel free to give me a call, 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. I believe we have lines open right now, because if we did not, my call screener would be telling me that you're waiting to talk to me. So give him a call, and he'll put you on hold, and we'll talk to you as soon as we can get around to that. I will be returning to the West Coast tomorrow, Lord willing. It's going to be an all-day trip. I spoke in a home group in St. Louis, Missouri, on my way out to Jacksonville. And some of the same people from that home group are going to meet me in a layover in St. Louis on my way back. I've got four flights home from Jacksonville back to San Jose, California. It's four separate flights. So I'm going to be, flying all day long. I've got a lot of connections to do. All right. However, I'll be back on track doing this show from home next time. I know there's calls coming in. I'm going to wait for some information from my call screener here. Okay, Dave? Okay, we're going to have to wait just a second here, and this is going to be fed to me audibly. I don't have my computer telling me who's calling me this, because I'm sitting in a car and doing a remote broadcast. Okay, Dave, what do we got? Okay, well, my call screener is talking to a caller. And by the way, call screener, I can hear your voice.
Hello, Dave.
Okay, our first caller is Dave calling from Vancouver, Washington. Thanks, Dave, for calling. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, thanks. I heard yesterday about Mormonism believing in that celestial birth. As far as the genealogy of Jesus concerned in the Bible, where would they get that from?
Well, celestial birth of Jesus?
Yeah.
As I understand it, now, I'm not an expert on the fine points of Mormon theology, but I've heard from the Mormons and from my research into it, which has not been extensive, that their belief is that Jesus and Lucifer together were spirit brothers, sons of God, sons of Yahweh, and that they were born of him before the creation of the world. I guess, at least before Jesus came to earth. I don't know exactly what the mechanism for that was, but of course, Mormon theology has taught, historically, that God has a body, just like ours. That he's physical, has flesh and bones, and that he has celestial wives. You know, a good Mormon has a number of wives. I shouldn't say that, because good Mormons today, in many cases, don't have wives, but there are still Mormons who do practice polygamy, and that was certainly recommended by Joseph Smith. But God himself is believed to have several wives, I guess. Brigham Young said that Eve was one of God's celestial wives, so he apparently believed God has others. And apparently, those celestial wives of God are believed to have produced somewhere, on some planet somewhere, Lucifer and Jesus as sons of God, and that there was some rivalry between them in that they were both applying for the job of coming and being the Savior of the world, and Jesus got chosen, and Lucifer was passed over, and that made Lucifer angry. And so he's an enemy now of Jesus and of God. That is, if that is not what Mormonism now teaches, I welcome our Mormon friends to call and clarify that, because I'm not attempting to misrepresent Mormonism. My desire is to correctly represent what they teach. I'm just not an expert on it. Is that the question you were talking about? Because the genealogies of Jesus in the Bible, of course, are talking about his earthly genealogy, and the Mormons, I think, believe that he had an existence before that.
Well, he did have an existence before that, but not on Earth.
Well, we know that he did. We know that he did. I'm trying to represent what the Mormons say, because lots of things Mormons say I wouldn't agree with. What I'm saying is, you asked about celestial birth, correct?
Yeah.
And you asked how that relates to the genealogies in the New Testament of Jesus, correct?
Yeah.
So my point would be that the genealogies are related to Jesus' earthly birth, but I'm pretty sure that the Mormons would say the celestial birth took place elsewhere and at a prior time.
But there's nothing biblically about that.
Biblically, no, not at all. No, not at all. Now, some Christians might hold a similar idea in some respects, although they shouldn't. There is the belief of Orthodox Christianity that Jesus was eternally the Son of God, so that before he came to earth as Jesus, he was already the Son of God throughout all eternity in heaven. And, of course, people might deduce from that, if they did, I think they'd be wrong, that Jesus actually was born at some time. I mean, how did he become the Son of God in eternity past? He must have been born at some time from God. But obviously, if he was born, that would be his beginning. It wouldn't be in eternity. It'd be at a point in time.
Well,
and I personally do not believe that. Yeah.
I believe in Genesis either 1 or 2. I believe it's 2. It has just the simple verse that says, "We created the heavens and the earth." It doesn't say God, but we.
All right, I'm connected again. Apparently, I got disconnected here. Are we on the air? All right. Hello. I am connected again, I believe. I don't know if I'm on there, so I'll start talking to you as if I am. All right, great. I'm sorry for that interruption. We're doing something unusual, a remote broadcast using cellular service, and apparently we got disconnected. There must be something squirrely about the cellular service here. I hope that we won't have any further problems. We're going to be going back to the phones now, and if you'd like to be on the program, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and you can call us at 1-800-438-5090 if you'd like to be on the air. 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Jacob calling from Houston, Texas. Hi, Jacob. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. How are you, brother?
I'm fine. I hope our equipment's okay.
Oh, yeah. It sounds pretty clear over here. So that's
okay.
Good. See, my question today is I just got back from a trip to the Middle East. I work in the oil and gas industry, and the firm I work with has some oil fields over there. So I spent some time there. It was really my first trip to that part of the world. And as you can imagine, I spent a lot of time with folks from an Islamic culture and background, and noticed that, you know, some of them, I mean, I've known through email and through phone calls for a while now, you know, very nice people, very kind people, etc. And my heart was somewhat troubled at the end that... have you studied in depth? I noticed that, you know, it's certainly not on your website, an in-depth study of Islam. And, you know, can you shed some light on its roots, where you think it came from, why the Lord, quote-unquote, allowed this? You know, I guess that really is a generic question. But you know, if you could point me to a couple of websites or books which would be helpful or something to that nature. I'll give that one to you.
Okay, Jacob, but let me ask you this. Now, you're from India, is that correct?
That's right.
So you've had plenty of contact with Hindus, for example.
That's right.
I imagine. Okay, that's so right. You know that not only Muslims, but Hindus also can be very nice people.
Uh-huh.
Although, you know, their religion is not necessarily correct. For that reason.
No, absolutely.
Right. And so I just wanted to set it up that way because I want to say that I believe that Islam and Hinduism and all religions that are contrary to the truth have an element of demonic deception in them.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't mean that everybody who believes those religions is directly, you know, trucking with the devil. In my opinion.
Yeah.
Many of them may be seeking the true God, and their hearts may be far better than the hearts of many people in Christian lands, even some who go to church, for all I know.
Mm-hmm.
But the religions, of course, you asked where I thought the religion of Islam came from, and I'll be glad to say something about that. Now, I know you normally prefer to listen over the Internet rather than stay on the phone. Is that your preference right now?
No, I'll stay on the phone if you don't mind, because
yeah.
I may need
That's
to
fine.
Talk with you later.
Yeah, I prefer to have you on the phone anyway. Okay, well, I know that you must know something about the origins of Islam, how that Muhammad was appalled by the idolatry that characterized the Arabic people, of which he was one, and he began to teach that there's only one God, and that polytheism and idolatry is an abomination. He had certain seizures and fits in his early life, where I guess he got some of these revelations during those times. And it was his opinion initially that he was demon-possessed. He thought these fits were demonic attacks because the Arabs believe in demons, as do the Jews and the Christians.
Right.
However, I believe his wife convinced him that these were not demonic attacks, but this was God revealing himself to him because he was chosen to be a prophet of God. And at some point in his life, he felt that the angel Gabriel had come to him and given him the Quran, which is obviously their holy book, as the Bible is ours. Now, we have to make some decisions here as to whether the being that brought Muhammad the Quran, first of all, really existed, whether he really was visited by a supernatural being, and secondly, if he was, then whether that being was from God or not, and if not, where from. Now, of course, there is a possibility that the man, you know, imagined this, or that he made it up. However, I've always kind of felt that because of the unusual things already happening in his life, he probably did see something or someone, And no doubt it represented itself as an angel of light. Though we know from 2 Corinthians chapter 11 that Paul said even Satan himself can appear as an angel of light. And so we'd have to judge whether this was really an angel from the true God or not, or the devil, you know. And obviously you and I know what we think about this because Paul said if we or an angel from heaven would appear to you and preach any other gospel than that which we've preached, Paul said, let him be accursed in Galatians chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. However, the message that this angel brought to Muhammad had some, if it really happened, you know, had some overlapping with Christian and Jewish ideas. Muhammad, for example, I think believed in the law, the Torah of the Jews, but he did not believe that the Jews were the chosen people, as you would find in the Torah, but rather that the Arabs were, that both lines descended from Abraham,
right.
And the Arabs, were the ones that God chose, and whereas the Jews had corrupted the Old Testament to make it sound like they were the chosen ones. So that was, you know, that's where he differed from the Jews. And he differed from the Christians in particular on the Trinity doctrine. That there's only one God, he emphasized, and he could not understand, apparently, how that could be harmonized with Jesus being God or the Son of God. I think he was confused about Christian theology, and it may not have been entirely his fault.
Mm-hmm.
He may have been, confused by the confusing teachings of the Catholic Church at the time, which is the only source of Christian doctrine that he knew of, probably.
Right.
So anyway, I think that he got confused. It sounds like he really thought he was a prophet of God, which means he could have been a sincere guy. Although if you read his personal life, it had some pretty nasty stuff in it. You said, can I recommend any books?
I remember reading about that. You know, he fought some, you know, pretty horrific battles and things like that.
That's right. I mean, are you familiar with a book by Don Richardson on this subject?
No.
I don't remember the name of the book, and I'm not at home, so I don't see my library. I have quite a few books on Islam on my shelf. Some of them, like I have the Quran, and I have some books that are, in a sense, sympathetic toward Islam, and then I have some that are Christian critiques. One of the ones that's a very scathing critique, I don't remember the name of it, but if you went to Amazon.com or ChristianBook.com, I think you'd find the author is Don Richardson. Now, he's a very well-known career missionary. He wrote Peace Child.
Right.
He wrote Eternity in Their Hearts. He wrote some very excellent books. He wrote a book about Islam where he actually tells a lot of the things you've just alluded to, some of the nasty, awful, evil things that Muhammad did in war to spread his religion. Now, of course, Muslims would say, and probably some others who don't like Christianity would say, well, you know, didn't the Jews do those kinds of things too when they conquered Canaan? Yes, they did. They slaughtered whole nations. But there was an entirely different reason for that. Those nations were slaughtered not because they didn't convert to Judaism. They were slaughtered because God had said those nations had moved in and taken over the land that God had given to Abraham, and that they were defiling the land with their idolatry and their abominations. Now, so they were being judged, whereas Muhammad, I believe, fought those wars in order to convert people, and many were converted, and Islam spread that way. Now, I can't give you a lot of detail about the religion. It's a complex thing, and my lines are full, I understand. So I would say that you could probably find a number of good books, if you want them from a Christian perspective, on ChristianBook.com. Just type in the title Islam, and I'm sure they'll come up with a whole raft of books, including the one by Don Richardson. I found it to be insightful. I would suggest if you really want to understand Islam, it might be a good idea to buy a copy of the Quran and read it too,
right?
Just so you'll know what it is they're hearing and believing.
Got it. As always, Steve, before you go, a very quick question. I'm going to email you on Monday on this. Are you in Santa Cruz next Saturday, November 10th?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay.
Are you going to be there?
An email next week, Steve, or I'll send it to today or tomorrow. You'll get it when you get back.
All right.
Brother, thank you
That'd
so
be great.
Much once again.
God bless you, Jacob.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye now. All right. We're going to talk next to Karen, calling from Portland, Oregon. And Karen, good to hear from you. Hello, Karen. Is Karen there? Okay. Looks like she hung up. Okay. Who's next then, Dwayne or Dave? Okay, we need to... Lost all the calls? Okay, it sounds to me like all the calls that were waiting somehow got disconnected. I don't know what happened there. That didn't happen here in Florida. So let me just urge you to call back. If you were waiting on hold, or even if you weren't and you want to call in, our lines apparently have just become open. I don't know what's going on with that. But the number to call, if you'd like to be on the program, is 1-800-438-5090. Our next caller is Gary from Portland, Oregon. Gary, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Steve. My name is Gary. I listen to your program often. I guess I have to turn my radio down. I know I've called talk shows before, and so you're...
Yeah, you should turn your radio down. Yeah.
Okay, I've got it down. Actually, I've got it all the way. I got a question for you. It was kind of a one that came to mind about the Bible. You know, Jesus talks about divorce, and he's real... adamant about not divorcing unless it's because of unfaithfulness. But what if you're in a situation, I'm not, but I'm just saying hypothetically, you have an abusive spouse, an alcoholic spouse, somebody who's, you know, that's unbearable to live with. Are we still supposed to hang in there regardless or what? I mean, I'm kind of confused. And is there a gray area where Jesus says, I'd rather you didn't do this, but you're not going to be condemned to hell if you do? You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah,
sense?
I know what you're saying. Well, yeah, there are definitely situations where it would seem intolerable to live with a spouse who has not committed adultery and who has therefore not given what Jesus defined as grounds for divorce. There's a couple of ways that Christians have taken this, maybe three. Let me just say, in my opinion, if a spouse is abusive and therefore a danger to others in the household, then those who are in danger, I think, would do well to leave the household and find a safe place to be. That's not the same thing as recommending divorce, because I don't necessarily think that, I certainly don't think that just because your spouse is a drunkard, that's grounds for divorce. I mean, obviously, some people are drunkards and they're not dangerous, and some are dangerous. So, I mean, it would really depend on an assessment of the safety of the situation, I think. And I suppose it more often than not be a woman that was endangered by an abusive husband, although it can be the other way around. I would suggest that the innocent party who's endangered by being there should take the children, if there are any, and go to a safe place and then negotiate with the spouse that they will only come home if that person turns from that behavior, seeks help from God and the church and whatever professional help their condition may require, and therefore just remain separated until such a time as it seems safe to go back. I don't think that anyone should have to live in a dangerous situation, but that's not necessarily the same thing as saying that the covenant of marriage has been effectively violated to the point of breaking it and freeing one party. I feel that we take the covenant of marriage much too lightly in our society, and even the Christians do. Now, there are some who would say that there are situations that fall short of infidelity, but which may still be grounds for divorce based upon what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 12 through 15. And there, Paul said that if a Christian is married to a non-Christian, he says, first of all, they should not divorce the non-Christian. But if the non-Christian party is not willing to dwell with them, he said, is not content to dwell with the Christian, then the unbeliever can depart, and the Christian is free. The Christian doesn't have to stay in that marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that would be grounds for divorce. But in that case, it would appear that the non-Christian, in most cases, is the one who files for the divorce.
Mm-hmm.
some would say that even if the non-Christian does not file for the divorce, nor, let's say, the non-Christian may not even leave the home, but they may, by some of their behaviors, prove that they have no interest in playing the role of a marriage partner. That is to say, let's say it's the man in this case, okay? If the man, let's say he refuses to support his family, to pay the bills, he's violent, he's dangerous, he's, you know, in all respects, he shows himself unwilling to be in the marriage, but he hasn't left the home. One might argue, well, you know, why should he leave the home? He's got a free place to live, or at least a place where he can do whatever he wants to, and, you know, if he doesn't have to meet any of the obligations to his wife and children, then why would he necessarily leave? He might stay in the home, but still have left or abandoned his post, as it were, in that he's he has not stayed in the marriage. He's in the home, but he's not in a marriage. Now, some would say, and I'm not sure if they're right or wrong, this would be a judgment call, and it would be based, well, let me put it this way. Some would say that in a case like that, the unbeliever has proven that he is or she is not content to dwell in the marriage. And therefore, the believer, Paul said in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 12 through 15, the believer is not under bondage in such cases, not bound to the marriage in cases like that. So, you know, I guess you asked about an alcoholic, and then you mentioned an abuser. And often an alcoholic and abuser are the same person. But not all alcoholics are abusers. And not all abusers are alcoholics. But the point is, if the particular behavior is such that it really communicates that this person does not have an interest in the marriage, some Christians would say, well, that person has basically abandoned the marriage even though they're still physically in the house. Mm-hmm. And would say that that's grounds for divorce. I'd rather be safe than sorry. I'd rather say there may not be grounds for divorce. And I don't think it's, I would never recommend that a Christian initiate the divorce.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they may need to get out of the house. They may need to do that. It may save the marriage to do so. Because let the abuser know they can't have their cake and eat it too.
Yeah, you know, I noticed this, and I'll make this brief because you've got other callers, but it's just been my observation of the church, and I'm a little leery of the church. Are you there? Hello?
Yes, hello?
Oh, yeah, I'm a little leery of the church right now. I'm open to the idea of finding a good church. I'm not shunning the church because of hypocrisy that does exist in a lot of churches. You're going to find hypocrisy everywhere, I realize that. But I'm trying to find a church that's truer, that is as close to the true gospel as possible. And it seems like a lot of them I've watched carefully, and there's a lot of, to me, holes, a lot of flaws, and I'm just kind of leery. You know what I mean? It's like, where do you find a real true gospel preaching church?
Okay, well, that's a hard call because I'm not sure that I have found a church that I would settle into necessarily. There's a number of churches in my town. Of course, you live in Portland, but in my town, there's a number of churches where there's good men who are pastoring and good people in the church, but where perhaps the policies of their denomination or something would put me off a little bit or something. But I would say that in general, you may find that smaller churches that have humble leaders who believe the Word of God are the most likely to provide the kind of fellowship that will be nurturing and edifying to you. I'm not saying there are no good big churches. I'm just saying that I'm thinking that if you're looking for uncompromising Christianity, you may not find it in any church.
Yeah, but I think you're right.
It's more likely to be in a church where there's a humble pastor and you know, he may pastor a large congregation, but it seems to me that the fellowship might be more, you know, accessible in a smaller church for you. I don't know what to recommend there in the Portland area. I actually have some friends that I would fellowship with up there if I lived up there, over in Camas, and I go and speak for them every time I come up to the area. But I don't really know if they have church services on a regular basis or anything like that. But if you, I don't know what to recommend, but I would say this, that if you'll watch my website or listen to the program occasionally, I will announce when I'm coming up there again, and I wouldn't mind meeting with you and putting you in touch with some of my friends there maybe they would be able to direct you somewhere.
Sure.
All right, Gary, I've got other calls waiting I need to go to, but I'm sorry I can't give you a specific direction to any particular church in your area.
That's okay.
I'm just not familiar with the churches there.
Well, thanks for helping me to clarify on that question. I appreciate it on the divorce. And, yeah, thank you very much.
All right. Well, God bless you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. It's did you say Kim from Portland or Kim?
Karen.
Oh, Karen. Oh, you got Karen back. Okay, Karen, welcome to the Narrow Path. I think all our switchboard went down when we put you on there last time.
Hi.
Are you there?
Yep,
Hi.
I'm here. Am I here?
Good to hear from you again.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I guess I might be your Mormon caller.
Yes, I know that.
On the original comment. I thought I'd give it a go, if that's okay.
Sure.
I got rebaptized 2 years ago in August into the LDS Latter-day Saints, Jesus Christ.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, my stand, inside or outside the church, is I'm a reader. I read the Bible, the New Testament, and the Book of Mormon, and I find it a very good argument coming out of the Book of Mormon, coming out of the Old Testament, Zedekiah, first year Zedekiah, I guess it would be in Second Kings. I enjoy it as a record.
What is the argument? I'm sorry, you said there's a good argument. What are you referring to?
Oh, the book itself is a record. I find a good argument in reading the Book of Mormon from cover to cover, not just splattering around. This is my feeling, both inside and outside the church. You know, people just start talking about stuff, planets and stuff like that, and my feeling is like, hey, you're on your own. You know, when you start talking about planets or gods. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think Mormon theology does talk about planets.
Well,
and
but
there are gods of other planets. Yeah.
The Book of Mormon was as a record, an abridgment by Mormon, and his son being Moroni, having buried the plates north, northeast American continent, buried 421 A.D., I find relaxing.
We've talked about that before, and we didn't get very far, but, you know, I wondered, Karen, have you read the religious books of other religions, like the Quran or anything like that?
Yeah, I actually have dabbled with Quran. You know, my limit with Quran is that, I was at Powell Books, and the front of it, I read the front of it, how Gabriel, the archangel, I guess.
When you were reading it, did you get the same feeling? Did you get the same feeling
No.
You got from reading the Book of Mormon?
No, not at all. I got a Quran, okay. I got it as a spoken, kind of a, meant to be spoken, kind of to create create an ideal man. I didn't find.
Okay, well, okay. Here's where I'm at on this matter. And the first time we ever talked, which was I think over a year ago,
yes,
if I'm not mistaken,
yes.
or else it was the beginning of this year. Well, it might have been January 1st this year.
Rough, yeah.
But we were disagreeing about this thing because I was suggesting that it's not really the feeling you get from reading a book that tells you whether it's true or not, especially a book that's purports to be teaching history. You know, if a book is just telling somebody's ideas about the cosmic, spiritual realm, well, of course, their ideas can't really be verified one way or another. And so one might say, well, I get a good feeling about this. I think I'll believe this. This will be my religion. But when a book actually is saying that it's giving history of a particular geographical continent, like the United States and South America and so forth, as the Book of Mormon does, then that book is subject to, of course, verification from outside historical sources, archaeology and things like that. And from everything I've read about this, it seems to me that the Book of Mormon makes a lot of claims that cannot be verified from archaeology and which seem to be contrary to what archaeologists have found. The Book of Mormon, for example, claims that the Indians, as Columbus called them, the Native Americans, that they had elephants and that they had horses and cows and pigs. And actually, these things were brought, the horses, cows, and pigs were brought over by the colonists from Europe, and the Native Americans didn't have them back in the days that the Book of Mormon is supposedly talking about. And elephants There's never been any evidence of elephant skeletons being found over here as native to the continent. And the Book of Mormon also claims that the whole land, North America, before the colonial times here, that the whole land was covered with buildings and cities. And yet archaeologists have not found any evidence of these Indian cities and buildings. I mean, certainly there are, you can go to Arizona and see places in the mountainside where, homes have been carved out of caves and so forth. But actual cities and buildings, there's no evidence that the pre-Columbian America had any of these things. And so I guess what I'd say is, when the Book of Mormon actually is purporting to tell history about things and research from outside the Mormon Church does not really confirm that and seems to refute it, that book doesn't appear to have the ring of truth, even though if it feels true to read it. It doesn't seem to be verifiable. Whereas the Bible, by contrast, has often been used by archaeologists from things they read in the Bible. They actually go and dig and find the very things the Bible mentions. And sometimes they inadvertently find things in their digging that they recognize are cities and names and so forth from the Bible. There's been a number of ancient kings, for example, which archaeologists for many centuries had never found any verification for their existence. People like Sargon II or Belshazzar of Babylon. And the archaeologists and the critics said, well, there never was such a person because we've never found evidence. And then they dig it up and they find inscriptions by Belshazzar or about Belshazzar and Sargon. And they found Sargon's palace eventually. And so, in other words, it's like the archaeologists kind of accidentally confirm the Bible because they find stuff and it turns out the Bible had already talked about it, but they didn't know anything about it until they dug it up. So the Bible and the Book of Mormon, they sound kind of similar in their wording, and they talk obviously about Jesus and have, they seem to have some overlap of their subject matter or at least of their interest. But when it comes to verifiable history, the Bible, has been confirmed again and again and again from outside sources, whereas the Book of Mormon does not seem to have that kind of verification available and does not stand on the same ground of truth as the Bible does. That's why I don't particularly find the Book of Mormon that impressive.
In reading it, I still find it impressive as a record, because it doesn't read like somewhat a narration. As I've read through that and records like the Old Testament, it reads a record to me. And when
Karen,
can I say real quick?
Yes, you can, but we've gone over this before, and my lines are full. But go ahead and say something. I'll let you finish this out.
Okay, because you spoke a long time. I was patient and listening.
I know it's my show.
It is. Okay, I'll let you go. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Oh, no. Okay, we'll talk again, I imagine. I didn't say you couldn't talk. Carl from St. Louis, this was next. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to have to turn your radio down. Carl?
Hello?
Hello, welcome to the Narrow Path. Oh, I'm sorry. What's your name?
This is Kyle.
Kyle, okay, I heard your name wrong, but go ahead. You're on the air.
My question had to do with the New Covenant and the Old Covenant. And I actually was in a Bible study last night, and we were talking about the Old Covenant and New Covenant, and we're trying to figure out the difference, like what's changed and what still remains from the Old Covenant, and are we picking and choosing? I mean, I know we're not. I know that Jesus did all of his work, and the New Covenant is, the Old Covenant all wrapped in the one thing. At least that's how I understand it. So I just wanted to get a better idea of what happened to the laws of the Old Covenant, the sacrifice, and all that stuff.
Okay, well, the Old Covenant was made with Israel at Mount Sinai, and it was made with a particular nation, and it pertained to them for a period of about 1,400 years, and then God came to them and offered them a new covenant. And only the remnant of Israel accepted the new covenant, which was, of course, to follow the Messiah, and God canceled the old covenant. So the new covenant has fully replaced the old. And it says that in Hebrews 8:13, that the new covenant has made the old covenant obsolete. And so the Jews who accepted Christ came into the new covenant, and they came out of the old covenant. And the Jews that rejected Christ tried to stick with the old covenant, but God has devalued it. God has made it obsolete. So they're saying that it was not a wise decision or good for them. Now, as far as things that have been retained in the new covenant, there's a sense in which we could say nothing has been retained. The new covenant has started from scratch and made a new arrangement with the people of God, which is centered on the presence of the Messiah and the reign of the Messiah, where the old covenant was focused on laws. But, of course, there are many things from the old covenant that appear in the new covenant as well. Obviously, the same God is in the old covenant as in the new covenant. The promises of the Messiah are in the old covenant, but of course the Messiah is the reality in the new covenant. So the new covenant is kind of a fulfillment of it. But you're interested, it sounds like, in knowing how do we decide which laws from the old covenant remain valid in the new covenant. Is that kind of where you're, what you're asking?
Right. Which laws, but also
the laws, what practices?
Because there's so many promises from the old covenant.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that the promises of God always belong to the believing remnant. And some of those promises in the Old Covenant are fulfilled in the Messiah and therefore belong to the people of the Messiah. Paul said in Galatians 3:16, he said that the promises were made to Abraham and to his seed. And it says, and that seed is Christ. So the promises were really made to the Messiah, and they pertain to the Messiah. And then in Galatians 3:29, Paul says, and if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed, and you're the heirs according to the promise. So the promises were made to Abraham and to the seed of Abraham, who is the Messiah. And those promises belong to the Messiah and to those who are joined with him, which is us. And so now some of the promises have taken on a new form. They've actually expanded. For example, the promise that, you know, a certain piece of real estate, of geographical land, would belong to Abraham's seed has now been expanded to be the whole world. Because it says in Psalm 8 that God says to the Messiah, ask of me, and I'll give you the nations for your inheritance and the uttermost parts of the earth for your possession. So whereas God gave the Jews in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant, he gave them the land of Israel, or what was then called the land of Canaan, as their inheritance and their possession. Now to the Messiah, he offers the whole world, the uttermost parts of the earth, and all the nations for his possession. So, like the promise in the Old Testament is kind of expanded. The whole world includes the land of Canaan, but it includes all the other lands too. And so what happened was the Old Covenant laws, they kind of foreshadowed a reality that was much larger than what they stated. They were representative of God making promises to the Messiah, but he gave the people of the Messiah in the Old Testament some little sample that he was going to give the whole thing to the Messiah.
So if I were to say that the Old Testament promises are true or expanded, and then the laws have been, I don't want to say removed, but have been, not modified either. They're still the same, but you don't have those other laws like the sacrifice, stuff like that. So you have the promises still true, and then the sacrifices, those are all removed, and the law that remains is what Jesus taught with the two great commandments.
Right. Okay. The promises are still true, but they apply to the Messiah and to the Messiah's people, which today we call the Messiah's people the church. The Messiah's people are the remnant of Israel who received Christ and the Gentiles who have been added to their number. So believers in Christ, Jews and Gentiles combined, we also call that the church, but that's the Messiah's people to whom the promises apply, Paul said. If you are in Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Now, as far as the laws, I would put it this way. There's more than one kind of law in the Old Testament. One of the types, one of the categories of laws revealed the character of God. And another group of laws revealed the purpose of God. Now, the laws that revealed the character of God are what we would call moral laws. They depict righteousness. They they set good and evil in contrast to each other. And God's character never changes. So those laws that depict God's character, like you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, all of those things are unjust, unmerciful, unloving things to do, and therefore they go against God's character, and they must be permanent. The laws that describe God's character, well, God's character is permanent, so the laws remain in force. But the other laws that describe God's purpose are the rituals of the tabernacle that God ordained to point forward to his purpose in the Messiah. But the Messiah has come and has fulfilled that purpose, so we don't keep those laws anymore because they were simply predictive. They were laws that looked forward to something. And they were, Paul said in Colossians 2, 16, 17, they were a shadow for the time being. But now they've been fulfilled in Christ. So I would say the laws that are moral in nature, that embody some principle of justice or mercy or honesty, that talk about the character of God and our need to be like that, those laws are of permanent validity. But those that are ceremonies, offering sacrifices, abstaining from unclean foods, keeping special holy days and so forth, those ceremonies were all symbolic of things that were to come, and those things have come. And therefore, we don't keep those ceremonies anymore.
So when I look at the Old Testament to determine, when I look at the laws, I can look at one and see, does this represent God's character or does it represent, you know,
Yes, you can. You can, but to make it easier, I would just say look at what Jesus commanded. Because what Jesus commanded was basically a repetition of the moral laws of the Old Testament. But he never repeated an obligation to keep the ceremonial laws or the ritual laws.
Okay.
So Jesus, the teachings of Jesus become the standard for the Christian.
Okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for your call. I want to take one more call, and we're going to be out of time, I'm afraid. Thanks for calling. Who's our last caller today? Jean from Prunedale. Welcome to the Narrow Path. You're our last caller today.
Hi. I heard you earlier talking about Islam, and I wanted to tell you about a resource I found. It's called Jesus and Muhammad, and it's by Mark Gabriel, who was brought up in a religious Muslim family in Egypt and had even memorized the whole Quran by the time he was 12. And he went on to study Muslim history and taught it at the university, but he was very troubled by things he saw. When he finally read in Matthew, he started reading, and he could see pictures in front of him of what Jesus was doing, contrasted to that same period of life in Muhammad. And the book is just really fascinating because he contrasts.
What is the name? Is it just Jesus and Muhammad? Is that the title?
Jesus and Muhammad. Well, there's a subtitle, Profound Differences and Surprising Similarities.
Okay, Profound Differences and Surprising Similarities is the subtitle.
Yes.
And the author's name again?
Mark A. Gabriel. Just like
Gabriel should be easy to remember. That's the angel that appeared to Muhammad.
Exactly.
Mark A. Gabriel. Moses.
Yeah, and I thought it was
so
fascinating
Jesus
because
Muhammad.
This is from an expert who really studied the.
Well, thank you for the recommendation, because I know Jacob, who called from Houston, was asking for a recommendation of books, and I just don't know the titles of them. I mean, I have a bunch on my shelf at home, but I'm not there, and I can't look at them.
Right.
But thank you so much for that, Gene.
You're welcome.
I appreciate your call. God bless you.
Bye.
You've been listening by now. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We have the program live Monday through Friday, generally. Today was a live broadcast, which is why we had some of the technical difficulties we had. We wouldn't have played a recording of those difficulties. Sometimes we don't play a live broadcast if I can't get to the microphone, but today, as usual, has been a live broadcast, and we will be live, Lord willing, Monday through Friday next week as well. We stay on the air because we pay radio stations for the time we use, and it's not cheap. If you'd like to help us pay those bills, you'll simply be helping us stay on the air. Yeah, I want you to know that if you send money to the Narrow Path, it will be used strictly for the purpose of keeping us on the air. It will not pay me anything. I don't take a salary. No one else gets a salary. There are no paid staff. We just pay the radio stations and the phone company. That's really where the money goes. And so if you want to help us stay on the stations we're on, or even help us move to some additional stations, which we could do if we had extra money, you can write to us at the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. Thenarrowpath.com. Go there.